Hello, everybody. I'm Michel Nashan of Wholesome Wave, and I'm the guest editor this week on foodrepublic.com. So log in to the political section of Food Republic for fun, facts, great meaty stuff, everything delicious, everything real, everything ready to go. Foodrepublic.com. Thanks, Heritage Radio Network.
Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. Funny how that works. And every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we're broadcasting live from Roberta's. Well, almost every Wednesday we're live. Sometimes we have to tape things in advance just to give you the best, most interesting conversations about taste we can. From 11 to 11:30 every Wednesday on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. You can call us, I should remind you, at home with questions by dialing 718-497-2128, or you can write in questions to info@heritageradionetwork.com. And I think today's conversation is going to spur a lot of questions from our listeners, because we're going to be talking about something that I think is a really fascinating aspect of food and taste, and that is the performance of eating and the performance of taste. And it was Joe Baum, the great American restaurateur, who said that all restaurants were theater, and he gave us some of the great restaurant theaters of the 20th century, really, the Four Seasons, the Forum of the Twelve Caesars, Windows on the World, a very poignant theatrical restaurant in the collective memory. And today we're talking with Dorita Hanna, who has the what I find a fascinating job title of performance architect, and we'll get into that a little bit. But officially, she is a professor of spatial design at the Institute of Design for Industry and the Environment at Massey University in Wellington, New Zealand. And we're so happy to have you with us, Dorita. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good to have you. So tell us, what does it mean if you tell someone you are a performance architect, and that doesn't really mean that you get up on stage and you have a drafting table and you make straight lines and write with perfect handwriting. What are we talking about in your world?
Well, because I'm an architect and a designer for performance, for theatre, I started off designing for theatre as well as specialising in theatre architecture. I really now sort of refer to myself as a performance designer, which is quite a wide term, really. But it's just thinking about performance in the widest sense of the word, and how you can design for that and what that means in relation to space, objects, materiality, details, gestures, etc.
So why don't you give people some idea of some of the projects that you've worked on? You work internationally. You are from New Zealand, but Dorita is always somewhere else in the world, and we're lucky that she's in New York now. But why don't you talk about some of the projects that you've worked on that might help illuminate what you do?
Sure. Probably one of the projects that's quite relevant in relation to this program is a project I worked on back in 2003 for the Prague Quadrennial, which is a four-yearly exposition on theatre architecture and theatre design. Mm-hmm. It was then called theatre architecture and theatre design, but it's now performance space and design, which I think is interesting too, that it changed its name. But back in 2003, I designed what we referred to as a performance landscape for the senses. So it was a huge site-specific installation in the old industrial palace in Prague as a sort of central focus, central exhibition for this huge exposition, international exposition, where people from all over the world come to talk about performance space and performance design. And basically I made a huge installation that was like a kind of labyrinthine journey through, in, out, up, over. And it had five towers, and each one was dedicated to the senses, in the classic sense of the word, the five senses. But as we know, senses kind of move beyond that.
Right.
And so we had, so the idea was that we built these five towers, each to a sense, but that the artists who worked in the towers would then interact with each other.
So presumably there was a Tower of Taste.
There was indeed, yes, the Tower of Taste, which we call the anarchic kitchen.
Lovely. Okay. I've been in many kitchens that could be described as anarchic. What made this one unique?
Well, the interesting thing about this one, of the five towers, it was the only one that the public couldn't go into. The others were designed so the public could move through them in some way, but this one, it was a little dangerous for the public to go into. It was curated by Arke Group, which are a sort of visual arts performance group from St. Petersburg. Huh? And basically, they just cooked up performance. It was just constant experimentation with you know, we sort of kitted it out like a kitchen. There was a lot of smoke and steam, and unfortunately, there was some fire, which nearly closed the whole exhibition down. But basically, they were sort of playing with the kind of the relationship between food and kitchens and performance.
So, in this area, let's describe it a little visually. We've got a giant hall, a sort of old European exposition hall, like the Grand Palais in Paris or whatever, and you've built this wood sort of slatted landscape with different levels, and central to this, I recall, was a table, or
right,
this idea of a table,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so that appears in some of your other work that I've seen and that we've discussed. So let's talk about what the table, why the table is central to you, and some of this idea of the performativity of life, really, but also specifically of eating.
Yes, no, absolutely. It is very interesting that over the years, even before the Prague project, you know, the table has been very central to my work as a designer.
And central to our relationship, because we sit across from it often.
Absolutely.
Probably too often.
Absolutely. And I think the table, as you know, we've had conversations about how the table is disappearing too from a sort of daily life as a place where people sort of congregate to connect with each other, and that's the thing that interests me the most about the table. In a way, it's a kind of a stage that we sit at and argue and debate, right, and think and talk, and food becomes the sort of medium that you exchange across the table, but there are many other things being exchanged at the same time.
And so if we're talking about food, I think talking about food and eating as performative is a new way for people to think. I mean, we have sort of had some of our ideas formed around that concept. Could you explain it a little bit? Like, what does it mean for them to, if you aren't sitting in a theater watching a performance, what does it mean for something to be performative, or what are we talking about,
yeah,
there?
No, it's a really good question. This word performative is a new question, is a new term that's come up,
right,
over the years, and people refer to it a lot. And I think it's important to unpack what it means, because it's quite a complicated idea. It's both simple and complicated. It's basically, to be performative is to be active. So okay, the idea is that something like, for example, a table is an active object. So it's thinking about how it performs. It doesn't just sit there like a dead object. It's actually performing. It's already performing the fact that it's a table and all the cultural aspects that it brings to the table.
So any table is also every table.
Exactly.
Maybe. Right.
Exactly.
There is no unique thing.
It's true, but so in many ways you have the universal table, but you also have the specific cultural nature of a table. So, for example, in New Zealand, in relation to Māori culture, the table, there's certain things that you don't mix with food and the table,
oh,
and cultural performances, etc. And that's very different to the way that Europeans look at the table.
What would some of those things be? I'm just curious.
For one thing, you know how sometimes we might be standing near a table, we sort of back up on it and sit on it.
Yes.
Becomes a perch. You don't do that
in Maori culture.
In Maori culture, you know, it's the idea is that it's yeah. So there are certain aspects then of where you bring performance. So, for example, in Maori culture, the meeting house is separated from the dining room because one has to do with the body and the other has to do with kind of, you know, much more sort of sacred cultural dialogue. Whereas for some of us, we would think about bringing those things together.
Sure.
So, and, you know, for some people as well, the table sort of symbolizes colonization, or the colonizer's table, for example. There's some cultures that don't necessarily sit up and eat at the table. So it's a very complicated thing that you need to take into account, especially when working on projects such as the Prague Quadrennale, where you have people, you know, we worked with over 50 different artists from many, many different countries to make the performance. And at the centre of it all was the table where all the senses come together.
Right. So a Maori person watching someone sit on the table would have a different reaction, presumably.
Yeah,
it would have a different resonance something like that. And in that way, that table is performing. It has, some other resonance.
Exactly. So I think the thing I'm interested in relation to performance design is to think beyond the performers, you know, that it's not just about the performers. It's very much about the objects and spaces that come into the performance, and that sometimes they can be much more of a star or a focus than a live performer.
Right.
So if you try and think of performance as a landscape of things, then how do you put them together so that they kind of create different focuses?
Interesting. So you travel around the world. You have been immersed in different cultures around the world. Now you're in New York. I'm just curious to bring it down to a more literal, like we're eating in restaurants. We're living in a city here known for its food. Are there aspects that you find interesting or fascinating or unique or boring or that displease you about New York and our relationship to eating and food and restaurants and American culture in general?
No, well, what I really like about New York specifically, which I think is different from other places in America.
We like to think so, yeah, but sometimes less true than we want to believe. But
it's that people are really focused on food. So food in itself has become a new form of entertainment. It's a new thing that people do. So now probably people who would have traditionally gone more to the theatre or more to galleries or more to other events go to restaurants and cafes because I think they've become events in themselves with this kind of interest and obsession and fascination with food and food culture.
And do you think that, what does that say about the other thing? I mean, so people are paying less attention perhaps to performance here than they once did other types of performance or to other types of cultural art forms or you just think we're just gluttonous?
No, I don't think it's about gluttony at all, because I think there's a way that when you go to the performance, you're devouring performance, you know, so it's a way of looking at a cultural act, participating in a cultural act. And I think also, as someone who comes from the theatre, it doesn't always, it's become more and more of a sort of passive act in a much more active culture. So I think people are enjoying more and more to go to a restaurant and sit down and enjoy that as an event. And the theatricality, even though they may not know consciously that there's a theatricality to it, you know, that the meal itself can be as satisfying as a night out at the theatre.
Right. Well, and then on top of everything, of course, most of the waiters here are actors. So there's a direct relationship between the performance of theater and the performance in a restaurant.
Absolutely.
And some places actually have taken that idea even a little bit farther. And I know that you have been fascinated a little bit by this group in Copenhagen in Denmark, which we know of as the center of a really important and growing food movement right now. We've had a Danish chef on the show, and I'm sure we'll be talking about the new Nordic cuisine more. But tell me about the Madeleine Theatre Company.
Oh, yeah, Madeleine's theatre is fantastic. It's quite unique. It's actually a partnership between a chef and a designer, which I think is very interesting. And basically, it stages meals. So it's called Madeleine's Theatre after Proust's Madeleine in remembrance of things past. But it's also called Mad Theatre. It's shortened it to Mad Theatre. And they're very aware of the kind of the double meaning, because in Danish, mad means food. Mad
right.
means food.
My initials, by the way, are MAD. And so
right.
I believe that I was destined to be a proponent of the new Nordic cuisine because they stand for food.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So... So basically they stage, I think they have four seasons of performance. They have four different performances they stage every year based on around the seasons and themed performances. And the public comes and shares a meal together. And the whole performance is around, it uses multimedia and light and sound and scenography and action to actually have you really taste the meal and taste the food in ways that you know that sort of accentuates it through theatricality.
Interesting. We're going to come back to that concept in a moment. We're going to take a brief break, but I want to talk about how some of those elements have entered into the sort of normal eating, the things we expect from restaurants just in general, after this break.
I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation Cure Master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
One by one, the guests arrive. The guests are coming through. The open-hearted many, the broken-hearted few. No one knows where the night's going. No one knows why the wine is flowing. Ooh, love, I need you, I need you, I need you, I need you, oh. I need you now. No, go stumbling through that house in lonely secrecy, saying, do reveal yourself. Oh, why hast thou forsaken me? No one knows where the night is going. No one knows why the wine's flowing.
Yeah, it's great. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about it for a second. So we're back. You're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, and we're talking with Dorita Hanna, who is an internationally regarded performance design specialist, artist, thinker. And you're listening to Taste Matters, and you can call us at area code 718-497-2128 if you have any questions about performance and design and food or taste or really anything, architecture. Dorita is very opinionated and very knowledgeable about design of all sorts. You can also write us at info@heritageradionetwork.com. So one of the things that, as you were describing the Madeline Theater Company from Copenhagen, that struck me was that the way we eat in restaurants has changed, certainly in the 20 years that I've been paying particularly close attention to it. And there have been elements of interaction that have changed and that I think are significant. I thought maybe we could talk about those since they, to my mind, have a performative quality. I'm thinking about the relationship between the sort of the guest and the chef, or the guest and the server, but also the way we interact with our food. We're no longer as passive as we once were, and it isn't all happening in the side, and things are put in the middle of tables, and there's a sort of feasting, banqueting quality to them. Any thoughts or observations or comments about the sensory experience of eating and how that changed and why?
You know, that's a very good point, and I think you and I have discussed this in the past, is the relationship between theatre and the restaurant, how in many ways, I guess apropos of what I was talking about earlier, the dining room in a restaurant has become a kind of new theatrical site. So yes, so we don't hide the kitchen away anymore so much. You know, the idea is that you watch the performance of the making of the meal as well, and of course the decor is incredibly important. And Professor Arnold Aronson, who's the chair of the Theatre Studies Department at Columbia, has we've spoken about this together, and he said that the restaurants are the new theatres, you know, where the sort of celebrity chefs are the star performers, and you know, the architects who used to like to want to design a stage show as a sort of special activity for them now want to design restaurants, because in a way they're designing these sites for staging
Makes me think of David Rockwell, who became famous as a restaurant designer and now is on doing Broadway shows.
Absolutely. And he's a great example.
Yeah. And the opposite is true also. I mean, Diller and Scofidio have done restaurants themselves. What is it? Is there something, I don't know, what is it about food? I mean, I know what it is personally about food, but you come from a family and a culture where food is very important. Not everyone does. Is there something, what is it in our food that...
Well, for me, I suppose you're right. My background is Lebanese, and I know that even growing up in New Zealand as one of the only Lebanese or foreign family in a small town in New Zealand, you know, the table was very important to us. And I think the table is an amazing way, as I said earlier, of meeting and confronting and fighting and laughing and crying over the table. And as kids, we used to hide under the table and pinch people's wine. And, you know, there was a whole world under the table for the children. So it's a very interesting sight. But I think it's a sight of commensality. You know, it's a sight where people share things together. And I think as we get in a more technological world of this kind of extraordinary ability to communicate across vast distances and virtually with people, the table also becomes more and more important as a kind of very material place to also interact with people.
Right. So having dinner, sitting with your iPhone or your iPad, your tablet, which has the word table in it, I just realized, but is a different experience, perhaps, that we're trying to, instead of engaging with an exterior world, which is that's about, even when we're with each other, somehow we're trying to find some relationship to each other in the space that we're actually at.
Yeah, and I think it's fantastic now that you sit talking and you can sort of grab your phone and everybody's Googling to, you know, expand the conversation. I mean, it's not necessarily a bad thing. And it's the thing I work a lot with my students as designers is to try and get, because a lot of them don't necessarily, you know, have a table, or they eat takeout with their friends or whatever. And it's to think, I had a student years ago who designed a fantastic kitchen for takeout.
You know, does that mean?
Well, he just, you know, I said to him, you know, we were looking at the house, and the house is a site. I think it was a project I called Domesticity and Dysfunction, which is how, you know, the house kind of represents an ideal, but the way people live in the house is not necessarily ideal. And he was given the kitchen and looking at, you know, communal eating and how everybody sort of might order takeout and sit watching TV with it or in their own rooms with it or whatever. And then he thought, well, what is it to still have takeout but to have it at the table? So design the whole thing for you know, in a different way. How did it reconfigure the kitchen?
So let's talk a little bit about this direct relationship between spaces and how we live in them and how we use them and also how they impact our sensory experience of the world. I mean, we're sitting here in, as you've heard us describe at home, in a place that feels like camp radio, with a wild boar gazing down at us from the wall in a wood-paneled room looking onto Roberta's, a performative restaurant of a sort, if ever there was one. How does the physical environment interact with or insert itself, as you said, in an active way in relationships with people or at a meal or something like that?
Well, I think it's definitely a player. I like to think of it as a player, and it has a role to play.
And if you were designing a restaurant, what would you want to do?
Well, the first thing for me is, how do I bring people together? How do I get people together in a way that makes it intimate and dynamic? And that can happen. I mean, a space like this is fantastic because it's warm, it's woody, it smells fabulous, the smell of the timber. You know, it's not necessarily about high design. It's about the kind of the putting together materials to create a sensory environment that allows people to commune. And I think that's the thing that's really important, you know, and that's why, for me, the decor of a place is as important as what's on your table, because it's part of the staging. And I really do believe that it can make or break an experience.
Are there any ideas that you've had that one day you'd like to work out regarding food or a kitchen or something like you described with your students or a restaurant?
Well, it's interesting because in a way, what I'm really interested in is as a theatre architect, and 6 months ago, I organized an international exhibition on theater architecture in Prague for the Quadrennial, is I'm very interested in what is a new theater. So for me, I centered the whole thing around the table.
Of course.
And
here we are again.
Many tables right. in the exhibition.
You have to get up from the table, lady.
Yes, I know. It's amazing. Even the kind of relationship I like staging between people is where they face each other. It's called transverse. But where right. the audience sees itself across the space, so like they're coming. So the stage is a kind of a table of sorts.
I digress, but I just heard that one of the morning shows, I think the early show, has just switched from their sitting side by side at a desk to a table concept to try to change the dynamic of the morning performance of the news and that relationship. So it isn't just, we're not just talking about eating. Exactly.
That's right. But, and you can see it on The View, for example.
Exactly.
You know, the idea of bringing people around a table to talk.
And the chew now. Also, the new food version of The View,
the chew.
Yes.
Oh, there you go. So, yeah, I think for me, I'm interested in maybe the new theatre being built around a restaurant or around food, around tables, just a different way of experiencing performance. Not that, you know, so that it's not necessarily about sitting like in rows in the dark, being well-behaved passive spectators, but actually engaging, you know, as guests and as participants in the performance.
Interesting. So we have a question from one of our listeners, which is great. He asks, can Dr. Hannah talk about how the home cook should think about design and eating in one's home? For example, how does one consider design when planning a dinner party or renovating a home kitchen? You might know the asker of this question. But.
Well, I think that's a very good question. And I think it also depends on how people like to cook for guests.
Right.
When I've judged architectural competitions in the past, my fellow judges have laughed at me a lot because I will often judge a house on the basis of how it operates for a party. I think that you know, for me, it's the hosting that's really important. How do you bring people into your place and set it up in a way that it's convivial and welcoming and that it performs well for parties?
Right. As opposed to the opposite, which is keeps people out and maybe keeps them discreet and you just eat alone. And I mean, what is the opposite of that? If you're not building a house for that, you're building a house for...
Yeah, well, maybe you're not thinking about that because you don't necessarily welcome people into your
right.
home as part of your lifestyle.
Just
I mean, for example, in New York, it's not that common to go to people's places. And
right.
I think the home in New York is much more of a haven,
right.
which is why people will meet in restaurants outside.
Or a hovel sometimes. But anyway, I interrupted you. You were saying
yeah,
about...
So I think it's also about in relation to that kitchen... And I was talking with someone about it the other day, who may be the caller, is that, you know, it's what is the relationship you want between your preparing the food and serving the food. And again, that's a similar thing to what's going on in restaurants.
Right.
Do you want people to see you in the kitchen? If you're a messy cook, I lived with a fantastic cook years ago in New Zealand who was, you know, a very highly regarded cook, but... food ended up on the ceiling, you know. So when you were sort of, it was, I loved her dinner parties, but I knew as the person who had to clean up afterwards, I'd be scraping stuff off
right.
the ceiling.
You needed to put a very cleanable surface up there. Right.
That's right. But you know, I think it very much depends too on how you like to serve people, how you want to welcome people.
Right. There was a time when the kitchen was as far away, so you couldn't even smell anything. You know, that there are cultural trends in these sorts of things, when the kitchen and the family room were together, but the living room and the dining room were somewhere else, all of that sort of changes. We don't always think about it, but suddenly it makes sense to have a big open island and to bring people around and to participate in the activity, even if it's just opening takeout
Absolutely.
Of serving. Yeah.
Absolutely. And one interesting thesis from a colleague of mine who's an architect in New Zealand, whose mother is a very famous chef and cook and cookbook writer, is that the new island bench kitchen is actually informed by the TV kitchen, you know.
Oh, interesting.
So that it's the influence of TV performing,
right.
and that's become a sort of mainstay in the home, but it has very direct links to television and performance.
Interesting. So we are, I mean, and of course, it's very common to have televisions in the kitchen, at least here in certain places that you don't that I've never quite understood, because when I'm in the kitchen, I'm cooking. I'm not really doing something else, but that's me.
That's right. Multitaskers these days.
I'm also texting and whatever, what have you. Well, thank you. It's, I mean, fascinating ideas to think about the performance of eating and the performance of dining, and basically the performance of everyday life is really what we're talking about. Maybe Andy Warhol really was that genius. We're all just, you know, we all just want to become famous, and we're acting as though we already are from day-to-day experiences. We've been talking to Dorita Hanna. She's a professor of spatial design at the Institute of Design for Industry and Environment at Massey University in Wellington, New Zealand. I almost said Australia. I am so sorry. Wellington, New Zealand. And next week, if you tune in on Wednesday at 11, we'll be talking with Adam Gopnik, who not coincidentally has written a new book called The Table Comes First, which is a sort of exposition of the culture of food and many aspects of our culture through the lens of food. You might know Adam from his work at The New Yorker, where he writes some of the most intellectually stimulating and provocative pieces on food and taste and all sorts of wonderful things. We're really happy to get him out to Bushwick. In the meantime, you can download a podcast of this show and all of the previous shows on iTunes, or you can listen to the archives on heritageradionetwork.com. We'll be back next week with Taste Matters. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.